Next up, we'll hear conversation. We now are shifting gears here a bit. We are going to Winnipeg, Manitoba to get a look at the Portuguese community and what matters most to constituents in that community. This is CHEBU Multicultural. They have the story.
Thank you so much for joining U Multicultural. We're really happy to have you here with us. Can you please introduce yourself?
It's great to be here. This is a great opportunity. My name is Henrique Braga, and I'm a member of the Portuguese community here in Winnipeg. I'm involved in a variety of different centers and organizations, and also do the Portuguese media for the city of Winnipeg as well.
So, from election perspective and civic engagement, how proactive Portuguese community in Winnipeg and Manitoba?
The Portuguese have always been very interested in politics and making sure that their rights, especially since the majority of the immigrants here in Canada came at the time when Portugal was a dictatorship and never really having that opportunity to vote. So the voting and being representative has been an important part within the Portuguese community. So they do, many of them are active. I think one of the biggest issues that came across, of course, were language barriers. And for elderly or older, it's still a language barrier issue. In really understanding the, you know, what are the platforms of each party, and trying to understand what that platform is isn't an easy thing for them. In terms of the younger Portuguese, the apathy that exists within the Canadian society, they're part of that Canadian society. So there, we do see some of that as well.
Mm-hmm. So we had conversations with multiple ethnocultural communities here in Winnipeg, and some of them mentioned some barriers. So you mentioned that it could be language. The language may prevent them to understand the civic processes. So what else could be a barrier for the Portuguese community? Maybe some of them, like some people from the community, they don't really understand how the election process works here in Canada. Maybe it is different.
So it's not so much the election process. I think that within our cultural centers, for instance, they use a very similar format of voting, right? There's a list of people who need to be voted in, and of course the ones elected is the one that has the most votes. So there is a clear understanding of that. Those who are watching Portuguese news, who continue to see what's going back in Portugal, understand the complexity of politics as well. I mean, Portugal has an interesting electorate. They have several parties that run. Split votes occur on a regular basis. So it's not that they're unaware of sort of this parliamentary approach where you can split a vote and work through that. We don't have a queen, we have a president, but we have a prime minister who kind of runs similar in terms of order. So the understanding of the system isn't the issue. It's often just trying to understand what each party stand for. And as our group gets a little older, accessibility to voting as well has, you know, tends to be a concern of, you know, do I really want to go at night to go to vote, or who will take me, those kinds of things. So going out there can be a little bit challenging as well. And I think the third one is the whole idea of, you know, will, are they really listening to us in essence, in terms of will it make a change, will it make a difference, and that becomes a bit of a question for some of our Portuguese community as well. So like I said, it's not different than I think some of the concerns within the Canadian society of, well, does my vote really count or not. We have again a lot of information that is available to people. There's a lot of people are connected now. They're connected to Facebook, and some of the other social media out there. And one of the things in speaking to some of our community members, it is really filtering what is fake and what is not, what is truthful and what is not. And so it creates a little bit of a trepidation of, what are we voting for? Who are we voting for? And is there some real truth in some of the things that they say? In some cases, it just makes them even stronger in terms of their attitude and understanding of what politician they want to support. And in some cases, it turns them away from it because they're just not clear and unsure of what is it that that this means. The Portuguese, in many cases, have really fought because they have been traditionally the backbone of some of the societies. They're the workers, right? So we've had the construction workers, the cleaning organizations, textiles, right? So they're factory working people. So they tend to want then to support governments that would then support the workers as well. And that's been a very big part of some of the Portuguese community members who've want to become politicians and have entered into the races and cases of that often go with that platform. So that is traditionally sort of where we come from. Portuguese are just working people, working class people. And so this is what they want to protect.
So, what are the top issues or concerns for the Portuguese community in Manitoba going into this election?
So some of them, and we actually did have an opportunity to have this discussion just yesterday with a diplomat from Portugal who actually came to visit. Again, it's the continued open relationships, and to allow for those continued open relationships between Portugal and Canada. There has always been a very good relationship, Canada and Portugal, going back into the 50s. Have supported each other a lot in both ways, through trade and those kinds of things. So they really want to continue to maintain that relationship as much as possible. Personally, for many of our Portuguese, they're traveling back and forth. So some of them still have homes there, and they just want to ensure that accessibility of being there. Not losing their rights for to being Canadian. So there's that again, sort of that immigration piece that they just want to maintain those relationships because it is important to keep connecting back to Portugal as much as possible. The other one, of course, is again a common one, and we do have a community that is getting older, and so healthcare has become a big issue for them as well, and making sure, there's a lot of complaints about how long it takes to have that knee surgery, getting an MRI for something that's come up, and so they're concerned about that as well. Interesting enough is that they'll try to compare themselves in with what's going on in Portugal. Can they be able to get it there, or not? And again, understanding that Portugal is on its way to a more public sort of health system, but they still have sort of the split public and private. And some of the procedures might actually be cheaper than say in Canada. So it's again just that openness of being able to have a good relationship with the two countries and keeping that open.
All right. We have some results to look over. The polls have closed at 9:30 across Ontario. They have closed down. About one in four eligible voters cast their ballots before Election Day, according to preliminary figures from Elections Canada. 7.3 million people voted in advance polls, a 25% increase from 2021. Now we're getting the rest of the picture. We are 40 minutes in and we're back to the national desks. We got Alan Gates back up here to tell us what is happening. We got a big poll dump. What's going on, Alan?
My head is spinning because again, we have over 200 seats, 265 seats where polls closed about 9 minutes ago, and I'm already seeing very preliminary results coming in fast and furious. So probably nothing worth reacting to just yet. Looking at Quebec and going out west, the results out of Atlantic Canada largely holding steady with when we last spoke about a half hour ago. The Liberals are still leading in terms of seats, or elected 22 versus 10 for the Conservatives. And again, this would represent actually a little bit of a drop for the Liberals compared to the previous election. Again, certainly doesn't mean disaster by any means for any party, and I wouldn't be throwing a celebration if I was the Conservatives just yet either. It actually just means that we have to wait for the next 200 and some odd seats to come in before we have an idea of what the story is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Like you said, too, we got like the Bloc and the Liberals looking pretty close in Quebec right now.
Yeah. And, you know, the Conservatives will pick up some seats, but the big story in Quebec will be how many seats the Liberals are able to snag from the Bloc Québécois. It's looking, again, pretty likely that the Liberals are going to hold on to seats in Montreal and even in a lot of suburban Montreal. It's kind of as you work your way out from there, if they have the possibility of picking up seats kind of further out from the Montreal area. And then they have a couple of seats kind of up for grabs in Quebec City as well. You had asked earlier on if there were NDP ridings to look at.
Yeah.
I mentioned a bunch of them kind of out west. The ones that the NDP are looking to hold in Quebec and Ontario, we've got Rosemount, Le Petit Parti, which is a part of Montreal, in the city of Montreal. We have Hamilton Center. We have London, Fanshawe, I hope I said that correct, for our friends down south in London, and Windsor West. Those are four seats currently held by the NDP that they're in the running to hold them. You know, again, we'll see what the night brings, but there should be some competitive races for them there. Also worth noting that Kitchener Centre is a Green Party seat and likely, at least in terms of the projection, to hold. But again, we'll see what happens there. So it's not going to be all about Liberals and Conservatives at from this point on. There are stories from some of our other parties to look at as well.
Yeah, let's talk about Greens. Is that the only seat that they're expected to hold? What can we expect from the Greens when we're looking at the Greens results right now?
Yeah, right now, yes. You know, the other seat, of course, is Saanich Gulf Islands, which is Elizabeth May's seat in on Vancouver Island. And right now, if I'm not mistaken, the last I checked, the concern there is that there might actually be more of a split in the vote. And the party that kind of may come down the middle of that split is the Conservatives, which is bizarre, you know, to go from Green to Conservative. But it is a competitive riding. So there are, you know, that seat is up for grabs between three or more parties. And so it's certainly not going to be a decisive winner in that riding. Someone's going to grab a plurality there.
Yeah, that's quite a transition, Greens to Conservatives. You can see really that the tariff war and the ongoing threat of Canada's sovereignty has really taken effect in a lot of these ridings and has really swinged a lot of them. I want to go back to Quebec because it's being, you've mentioned already, Alan, but it's pretty pivotal, this election, and it's pretty much a wild card. How unusual is it for Liberals to sort of be leading a lot of those seats, Alan?
Once upon a time, the Liberals won elections because they were dominant in Quebec. And then the Bloc Québécois came along. This is about 30 years ago now. And so a lot of how the Liberals do, actually, the Liberals continued to have success at that point because the Conservatives fell apart and the Liberals picked up seats all across Ontario. But now that the Conservatives are a stronger national party once again, a lot of the Liberal fortunes or misfortunes in elections come down to the swing of seats between the Bloc Québécois and the Liberal Party. In the last couple of elections, the Bloc Québécois has done fine, but not amazing. They've swung anywhere from about like 15 to 20 seats to like 50, depending on the election. And in the last election, they had 32, so right in the middle. Again, the Liberals are looking for the Bloc Québécois to drop seats, and they're hoping to pick up, you know, 7 to 10 seats from the Bloc Québécois. It's possible. You know, ultimately, the party that's had a harder time in Quebec, at least of between the Liberals and the Conservatives and the Bloc, are the Conservatives.
Mm-hmm. And let's just go back to Atlantic Canada. Like, we have, okay, so now we have some confirmed results. So Newfoundland, Labrador is confirmed Liberal. That's Philip Earls, a candidate there. Central Newfoundland Conservatives have taken that riding in Avalon, Newfoundland. We got Liberals going on there. So there's a bit of a mix happening here. St. John, St. Croix, Conservatives have taken that. But as you said, Alan, the Atlantic Canada is just sort of the first pack of the punch, and there's a lot more to come and a lot more to be looking at.
Yeah, and out in Atlantic Canada right now, there is one seat that's been confirmed as what they call a pickup, which means a party takes it from another. That is the Long Range Mountains, which is in Western Newfoundland. That was a pickup for the Conservatives from the Liberals. There is another riding further east, Terra Nova, the peninsulas. That one is still very close. It has not been called yet. There is a very small lead for the Conservative candidate, but it has not been called. So everyone's probably very nervous as they watch those results. Again, as a trade-off to that, there's a potential pickup for the Liberals in Nova Scotia. So they're trading a little bit. Most things, though, are holding kind of as projected.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A little bit of back and forth happening there. As we sort of start to maybe get into some of the Ontario writings as those polls closed 15 minutes ago, I'm thinking about Pierre Poilievre's seat in Carleton. Mm-hmm. What can you expect from this seat? Is Poilievre going to take his seat?
So if you want me to make a bet with my own money, I think he's going to win it. I think he's going to win it reasonably handily, probably not as handily as he would have liked. I think that, you know, certainly it's a interesting story. The fact that as a party leader, that he's not running away with it is probably interesting. But when you actually look at the projected numbers for Pierre Poilievre, he appears to be holding his support. What's happened is that the opposition support have rallied behind the Liberal contender and made it a closer race. But maybe we're in for a surprise. I'll be watching it very closely, as everybody else is. But I am expecting him to hold this seat.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how it turns out. As we're just looking at the polls here, my Elections Canada website, of course, keeps freezing.
It's going crazy right now. We've got results just flying in from everywhere. When you are talking about the party leaders, you know, interesting seats to watch. Of course, Jagmeet Singh, his seat is much more in jeopardy. And so we'll be watching that when the polls close in BC. And as I mentioned, Elizabeth May, her seat as well, is going to be a hotly contested seat this evening. So if you're looking for party leaders who are at risk, I'd put those two at the top, then Pierre Poilievre kind of in the middle. Mark Carney and Yves-François Blanchet is, you know, are likely safe.
Mm-hmm. Ontario, as we're seeing the polls projected which way they're leading, I'm seeing that Conservatives are taking a little bit of a lead here. Ontario has the highest number of seats in Canada. What would this mean for Conservatives to take this? Could that swing things?
If the Conservatives win the majority of seats, in fact, you know, I was trying to model a pathway for a Conservative majority. They do not need to win half the seats in Ontario. They probably, now based on how they've done in Atlantic Canada, they do need to do a little bit better than I would have projected. They probably need to pick up close to half. But again, if they're picking up, you know, anywhere close to half in Ontario, then their numbers out west are going to be even stronger than expected. Again, though, I would say, as I'm looking at how this map is filling in right now, there are almost no seats from the GTA that are showing up yet. There's barely anything in Ottawa. So, you know, while there's an early lead that's looking blue, I would give it some time.
Thanks, Alan, so much for those updates. That was Alan Gates again, giving us a lowdown on what is going on. Props to Alan for really summing up all those seats coming in. A lot of information to digest. We are going right now to Liberal headquarters for Evan Solomon. He is the candidate for Toronto Centre. He is just running, just started running. Marcy Ian was the notorious for holding that seat. She is the incumbent, but she did not run for re-election. We have Amber Ranson there now, reporting live from Evan Solomon's election party in Toronto Centre. Hi, Amber.
Hi, Mia. How's it going?
Hi. Good to hear from you. What's going on at Evan Solomon's party? What's going on over there?
Well, it looks like the crowd is really filling up. We're in the downtown Toronto, right near Regent Park. I'm here with Pam Johnston, who is a Liberal Party volunteer and a portfolio manager, and who runs an e-commerce company. We're just speaking now as the polls close. So how are you feeling right now, just as the polls have closed?
Well, I'm feeling nervous, excited. It's always exciting to be part of an election. And, you know, there's a lot at stake in this one. That's why I'm here working.
Right. And how would you describe the atmosphere in here? How are you and your fellow Liberals kind of feeling going into this election?
Well, I think we were, very motivated by the need and the real concern we have as Canadians about the threat of Trump and the way that our world has changed, and finding the right leader to respond to the change that Canada needs to make in the world.
Right. And Pam, you've been telling me you've been a Liberal since you were 13 years old, right? Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I have. I was a Trudeau Action Girl when Pierre Elliott got started in 68, and I worked for Donald MacDonald, the first finance minister. But I've also worked for the NDP. I mean, I guess I choose the candidate that for the time, and I get involved when I think we're at a critical moment. And I wasn't a big fan of Justin, and I kept saying to the Liberal Party that when it's Mark Carney leading the Liberals, I'll be back. And so that's why I'm here.
Right. And what would you say are the main kind of issues facing the leaders as they come into power?
Well, I think that it's, you know, we all know that Canada is not alone with the economic crises that they're facing, housing and affordability and, health and, you know, just a sort of general decline in the standard of living worldwide is a problem. And how we address it in Canada is extremely important. But beyond that, we have this existential threat that is in the form of President Trump that is truly frightening. I mean, you've got to believe everything this man says. And the moment he said that Canada should be the 51st state, I heard him and Carney hears him. And I was so glad to have leader acknowledge what this man was really talking about and that it was true. And then we can't let that happen.
Right. And what were some more kind of differences that you felt between Trudeau and Carney? Why did you feel so inclined to support the Liberals again once it came back to Carney?
Well, I mean, here, Justin, I'm sorry, he was a high school teacher. Mark Carney, as we know, has run the Bank of Canada, the Bank of England. He's an economist, and he's also a very successful corporate person. And so he knows money. He knows how to manage the world of tariffs and high finance and world economies. I mean, that's where he has spent his career. And I really, really turned on to him when he wrote his book, Values, because he was our economist and the economy, the way the economy is incentivized right now. And I know I'm in the investment business, is 100% money, 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 bottom line, bottom line, bottom line. And we've lost track of people and values and morality and taking care of each other in this world. And that is not Carney's vision of values is a very very pillared situation where he sees taking care of our world, taking care of the people in our world, and incentivizing that as much as financial success or more.
And you talked about kind of investing in people again, investing in young people, investing in people coming out of coming into different spots. Could you talk about that?
Well, there used to be a time where business, you know, things like the banks and the telcos and insurance companies all offered entry-level jobs to students and graduates from universities, etc. And you know, that all started to fall apart. You know, then those jobs became internships where these kids were working for free, and it's been all downhill since then. I mean, there is a moral obligation that business owes to it, the society that is helping it grow, and that is in helping that society function, which means making sure that young people have a career path or have an opportunity to learn some skills that will help them. I mean, you know, we got all involved in higher education. I never went to school. So, you know, but I lived in a world at that time. I didn't need to have a degree to be in the investment business. It was only a couple of years later where you did. But I mean, it's just motivating, you know, and incentivizing people who have money and people who follow a certain path instead of, you know, making a broader net for everybody. And I think that Mark Carney has demonstrated quite an inclusivity for all people and Indigenous people and you know, gay and you know, all kinds of trans, you know, just everybody. And it's not exclusive.
And shifting to a local perspective, what drew you to Evan Solomon?
Well, you know, he's in my riding, but it just happens to be fabulous because I love power and politics. I love the House. I love all these political shows. I'm a political junkie, and Evan is a political journalist. And he was the moderator of Power and Politics in the House and all the shows that I loved. And so it just was a very sweet coincidence. He quit his job. He was in New York for 2 years with his family. He was running a magazine. He'd always been in journalism, political journalism in Canada up until then. When Mark won the Liberal leadership, he quit his job and moved his family to Toronto, you know, and they are now living on other people's couches because they don't even have a home. But he came up here to run because he wanted to give back to the country that had given him so much.
Wow, that's really interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's a really wonderful man. He's very kind. He's very considerate. He cares about people. He's got a heart, and I think he can make a big contribution.
Well, Pam, thank you so much. This has been such a wonderful conversation. What are some final remarks for the night?
Well, gee, you know, the results are like, I'm not sure. It's the polls have all closed in the big, big, big part of Canada. And we just really hope for a majority with Carney.
Great. Pam, thank you so much. Mia, I'm going to throw it back to you. I'm Amber Ranson. I'm at the Evan Solomon Liberal Party in downtown Toronto Centre. Thank you for listening. Back to you, Mia.
Thank you so much, Amber. Thanks for bringing us that insightful conversation at Evan Solomon's election party. It'll be interesting to see if that seat turns out. So I'm Mia Johnson, and you're listening to the Alt Election 2025 National Election Project, coordinated by the NCRA. We'll be right back in a moment. We'll be hearing some more election results from CJSF.